welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Fred Nieder will be speaking on upsetting parables, bride and groom from the Garbo Dock. So, let's hear what Fred has to say.
It seems there was this pastor who had experienced a sort of burnout, parish pastor in a large metropolitan area. We'll say he was a Lutheran pastor, I guess. He was tired of many things about his work, a little bit tired with his work at the moment, and tired of committee meetings and fundraising problems that the congregation had been having, and he decided he just wanted to get out of this. And he thought it would be an easy matter to get a different job and just rest for a while and decide whether this really was his vocation any longer or not. So he quit, announced his resignation from his parish, and then began to look for work.
You seem to be the only one that's got a problem.
Well, it's been the same way yesterday. I must smell.
Shit!
So he began to look for work, and he looked and looked, and he thought it would be easy, but he just couldn't find work. Nearly in desperation one day, he finally answered an ad at a children's zoo. They said they were looking for someone for temporary work. He was at the point of taking anything. So he went to the children's zoo, and he applied for this job, and what it turned out to be was this. The gorilla at the zoo had died, and the zoo didn't really have the means at the moment to get a new gorilla. It's not all that easy to just buy a new gorilla. It takes time, and they didn't want the children to be too terribly disappointed, so they wanted someone to impersonate a gorilla for a time. And they had a gorilla suit there, and he said, well, you know, okay, I'll do this. And he was thinking to himself, it's kind of a demeaning thing for me to do this, but I guess I'll try. He said, well, what do I do? And they said, well, it's simple. Just watch the other animals in the cages nearby and see what the animals do. And, you know, just do whatever animals do. So he put on his gorilla suit and got in the cage, and in the cage next to him was a lion. And he watched the lion, and sometimes the lion paced back and forth and just didn't do anything. Sometimes the lion would rush to the bars and scare the children and roar and so forth. And sometimes the lion laid in the back corner and slept for long periods of time. And he thought, oh, I can handle that. I just do whatever I feel like doing. And so some days when he was in a pouting mood, he just laid in the back of the cage and sulked. And some days he felt energetic and he would exercise by swinging in the trapeze stuff that they had in the cage for him and so on. Some days he was really feeling wild and crazy. He'd rush to the front and scratch his armpits and spit on the children and do the nasty things that gorillas do. And so, you know, this wasn't too bad. He could just do whatever he felt like doing. And things were actually going very well because his blood pressure was improving because of all the bananas he was eating. His potassium level was getting straightened out. He was getting exercise more than he ever had before. So he was more fit than he'd been in years, and things were wonderful until one day he accidentally, swinging on his trapeze, swung too high, flipped himself out of his cage and into the cage next door, which was the lion cage. And there he suddenly found himself face to face with a lion. His life flashed before his eyes, and in the second and a half or 2 seconds that he had to think about this, he thought, if I cry out for help, all the children are going to know this is phony. You know, and they're going to wonder then, what else in the world is a big ruse? You know, what else is phony? So I can't disappoint the children. On the other hand, if I don't cry out for help, I'm going to be dead meat here in just a moment. So his survival instincts kicked in, and despite what the children might think, he began to yell, help, help, and the lion stepped closer and said, shut up, I'm Father Riley from St. Mary's! So things are not always what they seem. Which I suppose does fit in a certain way, some of the things that I've been doing. Well, I introduced yesterday in a kind of general way for the folks who were here why I'm doing the particular kind of things that I'm doing. I've been working on the problem, as I see it, it's a problem in the scriptures of polarization between Israel and its enemies, between Christians and their opponents, and the condemnation of certain people, individuals as well as groups, that have just been left lying there in the Bible. So as sacred as these scriptures are to us, they do devalue and demean the lives of at least some people in the world. And so I've been working on characters like Judas, and yesterday Cain was one of our people who we were rethinking at least a little bit. The place I want to start today is in an Old Testament, a Hebrew Bible text, which is one of my favorites, It's in Isaiah 25, verses 6 and following. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with it as a piece of the lectionary in the current three-year lectionary. It is the first lesson on Easter Sunday in Series B. And let's just take a look at this. Isaiah 25, 6 and following. I'm reading from the NRSV, so this will be slightly different than all of the RSVs. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wine strained clear. And he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all peoples, the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God, we have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited, let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And that's where the lesson ends, in the lectionary. But that's only a part of the vision. Let's keep going for just a moment and see the whole picture. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, but the Moabites shall be trodden down in their place, as straw is trodden down in a dung pit, though they spread out their hands in the midst of it, as the swimmers spread out their hands to swim. Their pride will be laid low despite the struggle of their hands, and so forth. So that's the whole picture of what the great salvation of the Lord will look like. We and our people will be up on the mountains feasting on wine and bone marrow and all sorts of other wonderful things, but the Moabites, our hated enemies, will be swimming in the toilet. And even if they try to get out, God will press them down into the dung pit so that they can taste that stuff while we taste wine and feast on fat things. So we only read half of the picture at Easter time. Sort of conveniently forget that there's another half to this picture. And for better or for worse, that's the way almost all such oracles as this in the Hebrew Bible. And it's not just the Hebrew Bible, it's in the New Testament too. If you look at the similar oracles in the book of Revelation, it always says, you know, we who have washed our robes will be on the inside celebrating and feasting, but outside there will be all the dogs and sorcerers and fornicators and all who lie and love evil. Yeah, so there's always an insider and an outsider dimension to these pictures. Well, the Moabites. Who were the Moabites? Anybody remember who the Moabites were?
They were the descendants of Lot by one of his daughters.
Right. Right. Genesis 19 tells that story of Lot and his family fleeing the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and all that survived the escape were Lot and his two daughters. I recall the mother was turned into a pillar of salt. And that night, or what, maybe not that night, up there in the mountains, then the two daughters decide we'll never get families this way. And so on successive nights, they get their father drunk and lie with him and get pregnant by him. And the Ammonites are the children of the one daughter's son, and the Moabites are the descendants of the other daughter's son. Do you suppose that's how the Moabites told the story of their ancestry? We are the children of drunken incest. Probably not. This is probably the Israelite story of where their hated enemies, the Moabites, came from. So throughout the Hebrew Bible, the Moabites are not just non-Israelites. They're not even just our opponents or our rivals or our enemies. The Moabites are the scum of scum. You know? And so it should not surprise us that in any picture of salvation in the Hebrew Bible, we'd have the Moabites in the toilet while we celebrate. Because that would make us feel really good. That would really heighten our joy if we knew while we celebrated they swam in the toilet. This is elsewhere too in the Hebrew Bible. Many of the New Testament's images for the end time and salvation come from the last chapters of Zechariah, which is very strange prophecy. But there too, over and over again, the picture, for example, in chapter 14 of Zechariah is of Jerusalem being saved, but everybody else being destroyed. And anybody who should ever think about assaulting Jerusalem will just be utterly annihilated. And there's some really ugly images of what will happen to anybody who even thinks of laying a hand on Jerusalem there. Flesh will rot on their bones and their eyes will fall out of their sockets or whatever it says. I don't know. It's not very pretty. Well, so this is a lesson we read at Easter when we're going to celebrate. And we conveniently stop just before the toilet part. And I've never chosen to try to handle the context of this at Easter time because there's so much else to talk about. But it appears that the same lesson, appears as the first lesson for Pentecost 21 in Series A, last year's cycle. And there it's paired with the gospel lesson of the wedding feast in Matthew 22. And it's the conjunction of these two lessons that I'm going to play with today in the way that I played yesterday with Genesis 4, the story of Cain and Abel, and the parable of judgment in Matthew 25. This all happened actually because I was scheduled to preach on Pentecost 21 last fall. And I decided to try to face up to the whole picture in Isaiah 25. And as I thought about, how do we responsibly handle an image of salvation in which, as most of the world's parties are, there's the winners and the insiders who celebrate, and the losers are in the toilet. I mean, we all know that kind of party, don't we? That's the world's kind of party. That's the way we worked it at the Gulf War. You know, we celebrated and we had all our yellow ribbons and we just had a big time while they tried to cope with 100,000 people buried in the desert somewhere. We did it. We put them in the toilet and it worked. You know, and we celebrated. That's how it works. That's how the world's parties work. Sadly enough. And it's not just as countries that we do this. We do this in our homes, we do this at work. Always we have our winners and losers, and that's the story of the world. So I decided, as I tried to cope with this particular picture of salvation, which is all too common, what if we insisted as Christians that we had to find a place in this vision for the crucified Christ? If we were going to put Jesus, the crucified one, into this party, where would we find him at this party? Where do you think he'd be?
With the losers.
Okay, so he'd be swimming in the toilet with the loser. Why is that?
Because it's the gospel of love and the gospel of saving the outcast. He'd be saving them.
All right, and you don't think he'd be attracted to sitting up on the mountain with the feast? While these other people were swimming. Any other reason to put him down there?
The condemned person.
All right, he ended up, this is where he ended up, right? They threw him out into the dung pit, killed him, and put him where you dump the rest of the excrement of the world. Any other reason he belongs out there? Well, he was one of them, you know. And Matthew makes sure that we don't forget that Jesus, he belonged there. Because you remember who his great-great-great-whatever grandma was, don't you?
Ruth.
The Moabite.
Moabite.
Yeah. So if you ever put Jesus up on the top of the mountain in this picture, he'd have a hard time with, you know, having every tear wiped away and no more sadness, because, you know, some of his people would be down there in the toilet. Because after all, you know, he had Moabite blood. He had old Ruth back there. So, this makes for kind of unsettling, at least for me it does. This sort of unsettles the party. The wine doesn't taste so good. And the fat things have lost some of their appeal. Let's turn to the, let's just leave Jesus there for the moment in the dung pit with the Moabites, and move to the other lesson for that Sunday, Matthew 22. I guess I'll just go through this. Familiar, but still worth reading, I think. Jesus has been speaking in parables, and he has been, this is, by the way, after his entry into Jerusalem, and there is some contesting of virtually everything going on. The priests and the chief priests and leaders of the temple are trying to find some reason for destroying Jesus, and they have engaged other groups like the Pharisees and the scribes and even the Sadducees to become a part of trying to entrap Jesus in his speech and so on. We'll look at the context of this a little bit more in a couple minutes. But in the midst of all this controversy, Jesus tells this parable that the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son, sent slaves to call those who'd been invited to the wedding banquet. They wouldn't come. He sent other slaves, saying, tell those who have been invited, look, I've prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything's ready. Come to the wedding banquet. They made light of it, went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his troops, destroyed those murderers, burned their city. Then he said to the slaves, "The wedding's ready, but those invited weren't worthy. Go into the streets, invite everyone you find to the wedding banquet." The slaves went out, gathered everybody they found, the good and the bad, so the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came to see the guests, he noticed a guy there who wasn't wearing a wedding robe. He said, "Friend, how'd you get in here without a wedding robe?" The guy didn't know what to say. So the king said, "Bind him hand and foot, throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen." And so we're right back on the mountain of Isaiah, right? We got some people inside feasting on wine and fat things with everybody else outside in the toilet with either their city destroyed or this poor guy who didn't understand the clothing situation, not just tossed out of the party, but into the weeping and gnashing of teeth of the outer darkness. You know. So this is a rough parable. What made this wedding fall apart in this parable is probably related to Jesus being out there in the dung pit. This parable probably appears the way it does now as some kind of explanation of by the Christians of how it was that the Gentiles and not the Jews seem to be the ones attracted to God's table, God's party, as the Christians understood it. The people who were invited to the party, you know, just thought this was a ridiculous party. They made light of it. If we put the best construction on what happened in the New Testament period, what happened was that the supposed son of the king for whom the wedding, the messianic banquet, was to be set, didn't look worthy. For one thing, you know, he had Moabite blood. For another thing, well, you know, let's just stick with that for a minute. Remember who Matthew tells us this guy comes from? Matthew gives us this genealogy that, unlike most genealogies, mentions mothers, women. The first one is, this is all in Matthew 1. Yeah, the first one is Tamar. There's another interesting story. The woman who plays the prostitute so that her father-in-law gets her pregnant. That would be a fun story to stop and play with for a while. Then there's the Ruth. Excuse me, before Ruth is Rahab.
Yeah.
We all know about Rahab, the harlot of the Canaanites. So we're two for two. Then we get Ruth, who's not anything but a purely virtuous woman, but a Moabite, nevertheless. And the next one, of course, well, we got one more. Except she's not called Bathsheba in
wife of Uriah.
Yeah, by the wife of Uriah. So that Matthew makes sure we remember the sleaze of this, you know. So there's a lot of reasons Matthew does this. But, you know, these are Jesus' people. And this is the people for whom he seems so concerned in his ministry. The outsiders, the Gentiles, the prostitutes, the sleaze factor, are the people that he would eat with and came into so much criticism for, you know, eating with sinners. Table fellowship with sinners was a great scandal. Moreover, he did not have a plan, which people had every reason to expect the Messiah ought to have, for making sure that Jerusalem could celebrate while Rome was in the toilet. That's what the book says. That when the Messiah comes, we will celebrate and our enemies will be in the toilet. Wonderful messianic text like Isaiah 11 that we recited, at least when I was a kid, children had to memorize this, and we would say these things at Christmas. That this wonderful Prince of Peace would come and he would judge with equity, and that, oh, that's so beautiful in Isaiah 11. This Messiah who was going to come was just going to, it was all going to be wonderful. But we stop just like we do in this other text. We stop just before the part where it says, and then together we're all going to swoop down on the Philistines and the Theseites and Noseites and all the other ites and kill everybody. Who's been our enemies, right? This is what all those stories say. All those promises were that when the Messiah comes, all our enemies are going to be on the first truck out. And so everybody expected when the Messiah came, Jerusalem would finally celebrate and Rome would be in the toilet. And Jesus didn't have a plan that included that. So nobody was going to go to his party. So what did they do? They threw him in the toilet and they continued waiting for the party that they expected. Right? So most of Judaism said, no, this can't have been the Messiah because we're still in the toilet and Rome is celebrating. It didn't work. And so this parable says, well, those guests weren't worthy. Let them be destroyed. And this probably reads the way it does to reflect the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So God, or the king, whoever this is, this king in this parable, destroys the first invited guests and brings in the street people. And except for one unfortunate fellow here, they finally get the party going. Where would you, well, I there's a couple ways we could do this. Is there anybody missing from this parable?
The son's missing.
Pardon me?
The son's.
Yeah, we got a wedding here without benefit of bride and groom. All we got is the father and the guests, you know. We don't have the bridegroom and we don't have the bride. Where would you put the... obviously, we're going to assume that the bridegroom is supposed to be Christ. Right? Where does Christ fit into this parable? Who's he most like?
Servants.
He's most like the servants? Okay, he does play the role of come in. Come into the Father's party.
But he also doesn't wear the right garment. He doesn't wear a crown. He wears a cross.
Okay, so he's a little bit like the guy who gets thrown out, bound hand and foot, thrown out into the outer darkness. Because he doesn't fit in.
Before his accusers, he's speechless.
Yeah, okay.
Going a little bit out of what we're just talking about, I'm surprised that the servants were able to bring in everyone who was in proper garment when they're going out on the street and bringing in every bum and, you know, and that all of them would have walked in dressed in the proper garb except this one person.
Yeah, there's a great deal that's been written about this, and yesterday Mike and, well, I guess it was during the session, not afterwards, you had talked about the difference between treating something as a parable and an allegory, and most people allegorize this at least to some extent, and the second part there is said to be about in the Christian community of the, you know, the second group that's invited in, the Christians after the people of Israel had said, no, we'd just soon not bother. They then have different problems. There are some people who think they can come in without the proper
credentials,
or the baptismal garment, or the clothing of righteousness, or the clothing of something or the other. And so there's two sets of issues here. One is, do you or do you not reject the Messiah? And the second one is, you know, do you have Christianity straight somehow? Well, can we let this party end up the same as the one in Isaiah? How can we keep the wedding feast of the angry and vengeful king from being any different than Isaiah 25, where we celebrate while our enemies are in the toilet? Do we end up with just as clear-cut a party celebrated in vengeance? Who's the bride, by the way? Well, we aren't really told who the groom is either, but we've decided, well, given the larger frame of reference, this would be Christ. And given the larger frame of the language of Christian, you know, that's just working pretty good. That's the first time I've
tried it again.
No. Yeah, we talk about the church as the bride of Christ. So that's all of us. We are the bride of Christ.
Out and try to use the initial people to the festivities, and who are taunted, he's taunted and murdered.
Well, that is exactly the role that in Jesus' ministry that he plays. Exactly.
Excuse me. If we're going to treat it as an allegory, it just seems problematic to me that the church would be the bride of Christ, because the invited guests are also the church, you know, aren't they? Or the highway byway people, aren't they the church? I mean, if we're going to work at an allegorical level.
Yeah. So, okay, that community there, the street people get to be the bride?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, it seems that we've got to fill in two roles there.
Well, okay, here's where I want to get with this. Where is the party that you would like to be at? Pardon me?
The folks who finally celebrate it.
All right. Do you want to be in this party in the way it stands here in Matthew 22?
Neither party looks very inviting.
Yeah, I mean, this party does not look very inviting to me.
It seems like there's a sign hanging up. We reserve the right to refuse service.
And if you won't come, we kill you. And if you do come, we're liable to throw you out.
Because few are chosen.
But most of them are chosen.
Pardon me?
Most of these people have been chosen, only one's been.
States are rejecting verse 14, though.
Many are called, but few are chosen. I didn't quite hear the beginning of what you said.
Well, if we take the position that most of these are saved now, then what do we make of verse 14, which says many are called, but few are chosen?
I guess I've understood that to be sort of a summary comment.
Editorial comment.
Well, about the whole parable.
About the whole parable.
Okay. You know, tons of people were invited, but in the end, only the street people made it. You know, all segments of society. Well, maybe the street people weren't at first invited, but the nice people were. Issues going on here. And besides that, we've taken a parable and done a lot of things to it that weren't meant to be done. So we got to be a little bit careful here. We're sort of romping here. We're not staying on any clear hermeneutical track. The reason for poking on it in the first place, though, is that it is all by itself. It's a picture of eschatological celebration, which is fraught with the problem of vengeance. And vindictiveness. And it grew up among people engaged in very severe controversy, of course, and the tension between the Jews who accepted Jesus as Messiah and those who didn't was exceedingly bitter. And Matthew's people, Matthew himself and his people were very angry. Undoubtedly, this is what they wanted to happen to the people that were not with them. This parable, by the way, is a bit different than the way it appears in Mark. Most biblical scholars believe that Matthew used Mark in the composition of his own gospel and edited things that he received from Mark. And in Mark, there is no destruction of the city, of the people who said, no, we won't come. There is nothing about this fellow with his wrong garment on. This is all Matthew. You know, Matthew is the one who frequently adds to the end of many things. The whole business about, well, those people will be out there in the weeping and gnashing of teeth, you know, so. Matthew is an angry gospel in some ways. It's also the most profound gospel of all of them on the subject of forgiveness and reconciliation. So in no way am I trying to badmouth Matthew.
But if it says here Jesus told this parable, then how come Matthew puts it in such a system? I guess I don't particularly care for the Bibles who have the red in what Jesus said, because everyone comes, I mean, they don't jack.
Yeah, the instructive kind of Bible to look at are the, there's a couple of them here in the library, something called a synopsis that lays out all the Gospels next to each other so that you can see what each Gospel has done with the same piece of material and how they've edited it for the benefit of their own audience.
So then it doesn't quote Jesus said this, the exact quote Jesus said.
Well, Matthew means to quote Jesus. But he takes liberties in, you know, passing on the quotation for the sake of tailoring the parable for the situation as he sees best.
Anyone ever told the story to Luke? Quotes Jesus differently.
Where does this one appear in Luke?
Well, Luke 14, really beginning with verse 15, it seems to me, is the part where I'd like to start with verse 12. But in verse 23 and 24, and the master said to the servant, go out to the highways and hedges and compel people to come in that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those men who were invited shall taste my banquet. And Luke doesn't have the guy tossed out who didn't have a proper garment on.
Right. Excuse me, yeah, that's right. This one is not in Mark, is it? This one is a Q thing that Luke and Matthew share. But yeah, obviously, Matthew's is the violent version of this same parable. Well, my own personal solution here is in the title of the piece that was advertised for this up on the kiosk. It says Bride and Groom from the Garbo Dock. they announced it at lunch, Bride and Groom from the Dung Pit, which is what I have actually called it. You know, in my combining or my bringing together of Isaiah 25 and Matthew 22, you know, I bring Jesus from the dung pit to this wedding. And then we tried to figure out where is the party for the bridegroom from the dung pit with whatever bride it is that he brings to this party. And it seems to me that that this particular bridegroom's party, at least for now, will always be in the dung pit. That is, that we need to remember as Christians, I'm suggesting, that our celebration of connectedness with the crucified Christ always means that we never celebrate, at least not now, we never celebrate rightfully as Christians up on the top of some mountain while other people swim in the toilet. That if there's going to be a celebration, we're going to do it here in the dung pit. This is the dung pit, and this is the party. And that there's really not going to be a party where every tear gets wiped away and where the reproach of God's people is removed forever, until such time as we've long since forgotten how to have parties where some of us are on the mountain and we rejoice while others swim in the toilet. Because that's the world's party. And that's what the people who destroyed Jesus wanted. So that can never be Jesus' party. And by that, I'm simply asking us to account for the fact that in one sense, none of us really belongs on some mountain celebrating while others suffer. So the party of the crucified Christ always has to remain somewhere else. So you're probably saying, I wonder what he smokes.
No?
Something that bothers me, I mean, in the sense of like, it's not a tradition, but it means that we're superior to Matthew, that we have a perspective that he doesn't, that he's caught in his hatred for the Gentiles. We're doing, measure up. But we can see about that. We can see, well, that's not where Jesus is. And the same with the speaker in Isaiah.
Yeah, or yesterday I was citing 2 Peter, who goes on about how his opponents are nothing but animals who were born to be hunted down and killed. You know.
Could that have something to do with the situation that speaking to a particular situation and audience, and that we are certainly as American Christians are not under any sort of persecution? It's easy for us to sit on top of the hill, so we need to hear the call to go to the toilet. Whereas if we were in the toilet, we need to have the hope of the top of the hill.
I think Jesus is, as opposed to being just in the toilet, he is also at the party. You know, Jesus is to tell the folks at the party, but at least people will tell you. As Christians, that's part of our job.
Interesting to ask a congregation for preaching on this when you'd like to know about his creed, because I'm not sure that we're quite that remote from that.
Well, yeah, let me combine those two third. Speak to both of those. Yeah, I was trying to say a little bit earlier, I think in the situation Matthew was, we don't know a great deal about the community, but you know, assuming that this gospel arose in that same period, between 70 and 90, when Judaism and Christianity were parting company, and there was already beginning sporadic persecution of Christians for being Christians, there was a lot of reason for enmity around. And the literature of the best kind that people write in the midst of terrible enmity is always tinged with it. There isn't a whole lot of poetry or fiction coming out of the former Yugoslavia at the moment, because people are too busy with other things. But the little bit of Serb and Croat stuff that is coming out in the way of poetry is not pretty. You know, those people are waiting for a chance to dance on their enemies' graves. Rejoice while the others are in the toilet. I mean, that's the way it is among human beings. A literature of any kind that grows up in times like that is always touched with this kind of polarization, and the people in the toilet wait for their chance to be on the mountain and have the other guys down there. And as if, I don't know that I would say that I mean to put us in a position above Matthew or Isaiah or 2 Peter. All I'm asking is that we watch out for when we ourselves get into that mode. I mean, I was talking about the Gulf War earlier. I had a brother who was over there in the Marines. You know, and there was something inside of me that every time I would see these pictures of those people over there getting blown up, you know, something in me was going, yeah. You know. But that part of myself I'm afraid of. Because that part of myself could, under certain circumstances, convince me that I belong on the mountain while somebody else is in the toilet. I have that for sure.
Yes. You know Mark Thompson, who recently retired from Global Mission at the ELCA?
I don't know him personally, no.
Yeah, he has a book out, I think it's called The Way of the Cross, and talking about our mission work among the Muslims and the Arabs. And he says that, our God's got to start talking to each other. Mm. And that's the same kind of thing. Have you read Phyllis Tribble's text, Terror?
Yes.
Yeah. And then the other one that you reminded me of was Renita Williams, Just a Sister Away.
Oh, okay.
Because you know her?
Yes, I know her.
Yeah,
yes.
She takes the black women, or the women from the Old Testament. And just one woman's touch, one little thing would have made their lives.
Your comment on literature made me think of Alan Paton writing in South Africa against the apartheid system when it was growing and consolidating its power. And to me, that's the kind of Christian witness that speaks against that kind of thing. It does not rejoice in the destruction of the enemy, but rejoices or has a vision of, of equality and respect for all people. So.
And we do have that in here too. I haven't said anything about that. I mean, obviously, there's a core of stuff in here that helps us keep our bearings. One of which is in Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. If somebody hits you upside the head, turn the other cheek. Vengeance simply is not... Vengeance and Jesus... kingdom have, they're incompatible. Or the book of Jonah. Yeah. For goodness sake, Jonah says, I knew, God, that you were like that you'd forgive the bleeping Assyrians. How could he?
Well, even with this story focusing on the inclusiveness, you can focus on that, which to me is in harmony with the rest of the gospel. That doesn't deal with the negatives directly, but it emphasizes the positive.
Is it possible that Mark is saying to his audience that just because you were rejected doesn't give you license to reject someone else? Because he doesn't have the proper garment.
Yeah, I don't know.
But there's an intriguing tension in the Isaiah 25 text, too. And I guess it almost makes me wonder if Tenet following his original, I don't know. You could speak to that. But in verses 7 and 8, again and again, there's this statement, the word all is used. This is cast off all people, and the veil is spread over all nations, and we'll wipe away the tears from all faces, in all the earth. Again and again and again, you get this very inclusive kind of statement that seems to pretty much cover everything. And then, you get almost like a footnote down here that says, that and then Matthew all dies.
Most English Bibles leave a little gap between the two halves of verse 10. Do those old RSVs?
This doesn't.
Doesn't. Some Bibles do that, as though you're supposed to see a break there. You're supposed to stop there and then a little while. Oh, by the way, Moabites. but the Hebrew does not break there.
Textually, there's no reason to assume that second.
No.
Is your basic approach in all of the examples that you use to put them in context to say this is a reflection of the writer of that particular time?
Well, I think that's one appropriate thing to do, to try to understand the nature of the energy that's being promoted in a text, is to ask, I mean, that's one of the things I always do, try to ask, what situation did this arise in that explains why someone would say something like this? You know, each of the four Gospels has such a clearly distinct purpose that they all have different features and different parables like this. Another
approach is to say, you know, what seems to have been the original parable of China. You can't say that, like, for sure, but if you take the two, if you take Luke and Matthew, and, you know, try to look back and also fit it in with what we understand to be the basic message of Jesus,
yeah,
then you kind of set some of these other interpretations not aside, that they're not, you know, part of the scripture, or they don't tell us something about Matthew or Luke and the early church and all of this. But maybe they also, you know, that, like the emphasis on the invitation and the inclusiveness and so on, that maybe that's closer to what Jesus was trying to say in whatever form, that exact form that original parable was told or existed.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a legitimate, maybe more fruitful.
Does anger have a validation place? Is there ever a time when you wouldn't want to explain more anger?
You know, if God gets angry and God wants to behave angrily, who am I to say, God, you really ought not do that?
Unless you're Abraham
and
Moses.
Yeah, yeah, right. Right. You go talk God out of it. Yeah. Last time I was here, we studied Exodus 32, where Moses does just that. God gets angry, and Moses goes and talks him out of it, and then Moses goes down the mountain and kills 3,000 people because the God forgave, but he couldn't. And then he says, maybe I can go up and get God to forgive you. Which, of course, God has already done. Moses is a little confused. But back to your question, or your point. My problem with the anger in the Bible is that so much of it, to me, seems to be people justifying the destruction of their enemies because of their anger, using God as the grounds or the excuse. You know, and, you know, that's just what human beings do. I distinctly remember one night watching the television during the Gulf War, and President Bush said, our boys over there in the Middle East are doing the Lord's work. That's the way we talk. That's what we think. You know, and nothing makes us feel so justified than killing other people. And we always say, it's God. We're doing this for God, and God wants us to do this. You know, and frankly, I see a tremendous amount of that in the Bible.